The Courage to Lead, Episode 42.
You're listening to the IB4E Coaching Podcast.
Brought to you by IB4E Coaching, business coaching for executives, entrepreneurs, and small business professionals. Learn more at ib4e-coaching.com.
Hey, Coach Harlan here. Welcome back to the podcast. Hope you guys are having a phenomenal week. I'm having a great week because I have been introduced to a guy that we share a lot of the same passion when it comes to leadership and it comes to courage. So I think this is going to be a very interesting conversation. Let me introduce you to my guest, Daniel Eds. Do you prefer Daniel or Dan?
Dan is just fine unless you're my mother.
I'm not your mother. My guest is Dan Eds. Dan is the managing director of Praxis Solutions. He's a speaker and author of two books, his most recent title, The Genetics of Leadership, Cracking the Code of Sustainable Excellence. Dan is certified as a lean practitioner in balanced scorecard design, strategic planning, group facilitation, and project management. He's also a senior examiner for the Baldrige Quality Award. After a career in management consulting, Dan began to ask the question, how do high-performing organizations approach the practice of leadership? He began to ask this question too many times, and he would be called in to fix a group or improve a system or upgrade a process. He never walked out of an engagement with the team feeling anything but elated for the time spent. However, too many times he would check back in after 3 to 6 months and nothing had changed. In fact, things had gotten worse. When he began to look at why, it always came down to leadership. Not necessarily individual leaders, but why the way of doing leadership institutionally, right? It was what he now recognized as a leadership system. As he researched high-impact organizations in manufacturing, healthcare, education, the U.S. military, and even groups as diverse as NFL Super Bowl champions, the New York Mafia, and the Salvation Army, what he found were organizations that consistently performed at an elite level but were highly intentional about developing courageous employees. This established what he can describe as the culture of courage. And you know that hits home with me, Dan, so welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you, Harlan. I'm just really happy to be with you.
No, this is awesome. Seriously, the New York Mafia?
Yeah. That one was just for fun.
Okay. I was going to say, yeah. Did you embed with them just to get a feel for things? That would be a lot longer conversation. This podcast could go for hours.
Probably days.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I want to talk about Praxis. I want to talk about your book and especially the courage and leadership courage and stuff, because that's what the podcast is all about. But before we get started, I do have a series of questions that I ask all of my guests.
Sure. Listeners,
you guys are aware of these. These are the questions asked by host James Lipton on the award-winning television show Inside the Actor's Studio. James would ask these 10 questions of his guests, and I figure if they're good enough for the Hollywood elite, they're certainly good enough for my guests. So Dan, if you're ready, I have 10 questions for you.
Sure.
Question number one, what is your favorite word?
Perspective.
Nice. What is your least favorite word?
I have no idea.
We'll come back.
Okay.
What turns you on?
Seeing people with little power flourish.
Nice. And what turns you off?
Seeing the abuse of people with little power.
Yes, absolutely. What sound or noise do you love?
I love the sound of birds in the early morning.
Cool. What sound or noise do you hate?
People playing soccer in the soccer field right in back of our house at 3 o'clock in the morning.
What are they thinking? All right. What is your favorite curse word?
My wife would probably say it rhymes a lot with damn.
Okay. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Oh, great question. Probably a photojournalist.
Okay. And what profession would you not like to do?
Garbage collecting.
Okay. We'll go back to question number two. What's your favorite or least favorite word?
I'm thinking of empowerment, not because I don't like the concept. I love the concept, but it's really an important concept, and the word is so overused that we've lost the context.
Yes, concur. All right, question number 10, finally. Okay. Dan, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Well done.
Well done. Awesome. All right, Dan, we're going to get into all this stuff. We'll probably talk about the mafia again, just because I think it's a fun topic. Okay. Talk about your book. Talk about high-performing organizations. All right, okay. And we'll get to all that right after this, so stick with us.
Imagine having a trusted group of CEOs at your disposal. Imagine having your very own peer advisory team who could work you through the problems and questions in your business before you had to make those difficult decisions. Imagine you had a group of advisors that had your back and met for the sole purpose of making you successful in your business. What would you be able to accomplish then? Well, you don't have to imagine anymore. You can have that and more when you join my Business Success Mastermind Group. Join my Business Success Mastermind Group today. Learn more at ib4e-coaching.com/mastermind.
And we're back with Dan Eds. Dan, thank you again for agreeing to be on the podcast. Excited to have you here. Love your content, the book, your website, everything. Love to hear about it. So tell me, you got started, you were a management consultant. Right. Yep. What did you focus on? What was your expertise?
Well, there's a couple of things. I've been kind of a generalist, so I've done a lot of work around process improvement, organizational assessments, in working with public sector organizations. A lot of it has had to do with cost recovery and helping cities and counties and states fully recover their cost and nice. When it's appropriate to do so. Nice. And that always involves some kind of review of their processes and process analysis. So that's the circle.
Excellent. Yeah, that's my background too, is process reengineering, process, cleaning up and the lean manufacturing.
Right.
Absolutely. Very good. And so when did you start Praxis?
Started Praxis in 2011 or 12.
Okay. And was that just... How did you decide to go out on your own? Do you just want to do things your own way? Or
Yes. I had been working with a small consulting firm here in the Pacific Northwest, and the recession had hit us pretty hard. And I was losing hours and the ability to make a living. And so I thought, there's this other thing that I've always wanted to do. And this was now the time to do it. And so I'd always wanted to do more work around helping organizations with their processes, using things like, balanced scorecard design, helping organizations really move into an area where they are providing not only excellent service to their customers, but also providing something of real value culturally to their employees. So it just seemed like a natural time to make the leap, and so I made the leap. So here nice. I am.
For those that may be listening, don't really understand the balanced scorecard. Talk a little bit about that. It's kind of setting up the metrics, right, and then measuring your performance.
Yeah, it's really setting up the metrics for how you measure the organizational excellence. And there's essentially four lenses or four views, if you will. What's the value being delivered to the customer? What processes actually drive value, as opposed to which processes don't drive value? Mm-hmm. And how do you measure the difference between the two? Looking at the basic resources of the organization and how those are used. And that actually had a big part in the development of the book, was understanding the resources that every organization has that can be developed to deliver value to customers. Okay. And I'll make the jump to the book here, if you don't mind for a second, Harlan. Yeah. So one of the things I discovered in researching high impact organizations is that they have a near obsession with value. And it's not just, you know, delivering value to customers, but it's also, how do they value their people? Do they view their people as an asset to be managed or as a resource that can be developed? It sounds like a nuance, but when you actually get down to organizational culture and leadership, it's a massive difference. And then, you know, we've worked in the area of process design, process redesign, reengineering. That really is a statement or an approach to capturing more value out of the financial resources that we have available to us. And then the whole idea of knowledge. One of the interesting things I found was that high impact organizations really approach knowledge and the creation of new knowledge in a way that's very granular, very specific. They're not necessarily looking for the big new idea that's going to transform the world. They want to transform, you know, their world a little bit every day, which then leads to the bigger, you know, disruptive type of new technology. Sure. But by practicing, you know, this value creation of new knowledge every day, it makes innovation a daily occurrence.
Absolutely. That is awesome. And then the value metrics, are those just within the company or do you look at the industry standards for that to try to set the measurements?
Oh, I think it's both. I'm a big believer that you have to have benchmarks. If you don't, you never know what you're doing if you don't have some kind of benchmarks. You need to have some kind of targets, but it's all in context. So, you know, the metrics that a hospital might use to, let's say, measure fear in the workplace mm-hmm. is going to be different than a manufacturing company.
Sure.
Which is going to be different than a technology firm, which is going to be different from an educational organization. Yeah. So you have to include the context of the organization.
Yeah. Now you and I understand culture and the importance of culture. But there's a lot of people that when I talk to culture, they don't understand what I mean. You know, they think of culture as a nationality or something like that. Yep. Talk to me a little bit about what is company culture and why is that so important?
Well, it's important because it's the ultimate competitive advantage. Your culture is yours. And nobody can come in and compete with your culture because it's yours. Mm-hmm. Culture is the ultimate value creator. It's how things happen. It's how work gets accomplished. Culture includes organizational values or lack thereof. Culture includes a big part of culture is how leadership happens or doesn't. You know, we talk a lot about courage, and that's a favorite topic of yours. It's a favorite topic of mine. When I saw in doing the research for the book, when I saw how organizations were intentionally creating cultures of courage, and frankly, most of them, I don't think would have thought of that idea. They just sort of did it because they thought it was a good idea. Yeah. But when they went about intentionally creating a culture of courage, it was stunning. It was a stunning thing to see. In fact, I saw that it was a hospital organization that's been rated nationally for the last 8 or 9 years as one of the safest hospitals in America. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't sound like a big deal until you realize that accidental and avoidable deaths in hospitals is like the third or fourth leading cause of death in America.
That would scare people if they actually knew that statistic.
Now, having known it, I appreciate my healthcare organization a whole lot.
I'm going to start going
more.
To my veterinarian. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
right. But when I saw what they were doing to intentionally create a culture of courage within their broader context of a culture of safety, I was so blown away with it that I actually called up a mentor through the course of doing the research for the book, a mentor at Harvard University. Her name is Barbara Kellerman. And I said, this is what I'm saying. Can you explain it to me? And she said, yes. And here's five books you need to read. But, one of them was a book called An Everyone Culture, a terrific book that really talks about how organizations are redesigning the workplace to be a place of humanity, a place of safety, and a place of personal as well as professional growth. And they are developing better human beings, but oh, by the way, they're leaders in their industry and creating more value and for their customers and more profits for their shareholders. Wow.
That's awesome. So in all your research, can you give us an example of one of the types of culture of courage that you saw?
Sure. So a manufacturing company, actually not too far from where I'm at now, 200 employees, they design and manufacture custom commercial furniture, have been since the late 1980s. If you walked in their door, you would see, oh, they're practicing lean, and they're a huge implementer of the Toyota production system. And actually, when I took my tour, we got done, and the tour is all about lean. And it's a remarkable organization, just from the standpoint of their production, their manufacturing systems. You walk in, and you would not think you're in a manufacturing organization or a facility. It's quiet. You could actually have a conversation. I mean, there's a certain hum that's going on for sure, but there's no offices.
Wow.
200 employees, and there's not one office. There's whiteboards all over the place with, you know, markers. So if you want to have a conversation with somebody, back to when I sat down with one of their senior leaders, we sat down at a table, and I'm looking at this table, and the table is whiteboard material. And I'm asking him questions about the company. He's grabbing markers and he's drawing me pictures on the table.
Nice.
But this organization has established a culture where everybody has a voice.
Nice. Yeah.
They reward everybody for doing Kaizen, which is, as you know, it's a shorter term lean initiative, more personal. They reward everybody for doing Kaizen. And they reward them whether or not the Kaizen is for the company or a personal Kaizen.
Right.
So for the company, it's things like, you know, okay, how do we do, you know, how do we improve this system, this process, or this step, or this manufacturing task? Personal Kaizen, I heard anything from reorganizing the inside of a sailboat to one guy who probably made the mistake of trying to reorganize his wife's kitchen pantry. But everybody is rewarded for doing Kaizen. Yeah. And 200 employees on their own, not leaders, but 200 employees initiate 1,000 to 1,250 Kaizens every year.
Wow.
Each one saves the company about $1,000. It's the equivalent of pulling 4 to 5% of gross sales out of their cost structure each and every year. And when you think about that, they are not only creating enormous value for their customers because they're doing better job every year, but that gives them tremendous flexibility in what to do with that excess value, if you will. They could pass it on to their customers. They could pass it on to employees. They could pass it on to shareholders. And oh, by the way, the first thing that you notice when you walk in the door of the of the plant, people are smiling.
Yeah, that is nice. Yeah, the whole Kaizen and Lean, for those that aren't familiar with it and stuff, it's just about eliminating the waste, any waste, whether it's time, materials, movements, actions.
Yep.
And like I said, in having that improvement go into all aspects of your life, anything you can do to improve something. And they're not huge improvements. Usually they're tiny things, moving this small material from one space to another, so it's easier access.
Right.
We tried to do that years ago at Lockheed Aircraft when I worked out there. Instead of having the machinists have to walk all the way across the other side of the building to get tools, they brought in tool cribs closer to the machine. So it's less time to go down and just little things like that. And it can add up over time.
Yep.
That's excellent.
But culturally, to make that work, what I found, to make that work, you really have to embed some basic values into the leadership and how they lead. Mm-hmm. So in this organization, they put enormous trust into their employees. They even have gone so far as rename leaders and managers. They don't call them managers and production leads and, you know, manufacturing, you know, whatever. They call them mentors.
Nice.
Because it's that word mentor is a reflection of the relationship that they want between the leader and the staff person.
Exactly.
So one of the stories, as I was going through their tour, there was a woman who had just been with a company a few months. She told us how she had seen an opportunity to get five parts out of a large piece of foam core material where they had been getting four parts. And so she saw this and she thought if they could just reconfigure the size of the larger, you know, piece of raw material, that she can get five parts out of this. And so she says, I went to my mentor and asked her what she thought. And my mentor walked me through the process of Kaizen. And my mentor did this. And my mentor said that. Meanwhile, every time she used the word mentor, she would just sort of turn to this woman that was standing next to her. And so when she got done with her story, I finally had to ask the dumb question. I said, so is this woman your supervisor? And she goes like this. Well, I guess so, but we just call them mentors. Nice. But, you know, I thought that that's a great image of a culture. They wouldn't think of it as a culture of courage. Yet. Yeah. Everybody has the opportunity to have a voice, to make a contribution, and give their best to the organization, which takes courage.
Absolutely. And I was going to say, for some business owners and leaders, that is scary.
It's terrifying.
To say, I'm open to your ideas you may have for us. You know, that we talk about intellectual courage, being able to set your long-held beliefs aside and make room for somebody else's ideas.
Yep.
For a leader to turn to the employees and say, we want to improve this. How would you suggest we do it? That could be scary.
Yeah.
Because you're thinking, oh, this person's going to show me up. I should have thought of this on my own. It's like, you can't think of it all yourself.
Nope.
You know?
Yep.
Be open. Yes, absolutely. That's great. Love the title of your book too, The Genetics of Leadership, Cracking the Code of Sustainable Excellence. How long did you work on the book?
Forever in some ways. sort of officially though, probably 4 years.
Okay.
And it really started, as you alluded to, it really started from a number of engagements, a number of conversations where I just realized that there was something wrong with the way we were approaching leadership. And it wasn't just my clients. Because I would go into the office of the executive leadership and they'd all have on their bookcases the same books, you know, the latest book on leadership. And we talk about this writer, that book or whatever. And then I'd go and I'd be working with their staff and I'm thinking, there's this disconnect. And in many times I would ask the question, well, you know, what's your culture like, or, you know, what are your competitive advantages, and invariably, you know, executive leadership would say, oh, we have this amazing staff. They're just phenomenal. We couldn't do what we do without this incredible workforce. True. But then I'd go and work and start working with that workforce and they're exhausted. They feel underappreciated. They feel like no one really cares about them, that no one's going to listen to them. Why should they bother giving their best when nobody cares?
Sure.
And so one day it was sort of an epiphany. I just said, I wonder how high performing organizations, how do they do this thing of leadership? There was another little sort of question too. And I was thinking, is there any indication that they do it in a way that's systemic or that's systematic? And anytime we start talking about, you know, systemic and systematic systems, we start getting into the academic ozone pretty quickly. But it's basically the idea that there is a way of doing it. There is a prescribed way of doing leadership. So I was kind of looking at that. And when I got looking at organizations that consistently perform at a high level, typically around the idea or the concepts of employee engagement, every time I found a strong evidence of a systemic approach to leadership. One case was the hospital that I referenced, that's one of the safest in the nation. When I got looking at them and I met with one of their senior leaders, she gave me an entire morning, actually. I finally asked her, I said, so you are really describing, actually requiring your leaders to perform, to behave in a very, in very specific ways. Even down to the idea that if you're a leader in that organization, let's say you're a clinic manager, you are trained not to become everybody's problem solver, which most of us become leaders because of our ability to solve problems.
Right.
That's where we get our bonuses. Mm-hmm. They take the opposite approach. They say, we don't want you to be everybody's problem solvers, because Harlan, if I came to you and said, I'm having this problem, what do you think I should do? If you solved it for me, it's going to make you feel good, but it's going to reinforce the idea that I can't solve my own problems.
Or you don't have to because someone else will.
Or I don't have to because somebody else will. But if you work with me and help me understand the context of the problem, the breadth of the problem, the scope of the problem, who else is involved, who else needs to be consulted in terms of coming up with a solution, that's fine. But then it's up to me to actually find the solution. And when you do that, you have just empowered me, my energy, my creativity, my passion for the healthcare organization. And oh, by the way, you've just improved my self-confidence, which not only helps me personally, but professionally as well.
Absolutely. And I try to do that with my clients, you know, teach them. When somebody comes and asks you a question, don't give them the answer. Mm-hmm. Ask a question in return.
Sure.
What, you know, how do you think this should be done? Well, I don't know. Okay. But if you did know, how would you go about it? How have you seen other people do it? You know, what makes most sense to you? And try to push it back on them. Let them come up with a solution and you praise them for it. If they do something pretty close to what you would do, coach them. Hey, that's great. It worked. Next time, try this.
Right.
But you want to try to build that confidence, right?
Yep.
That's one thing that I think leaders need to do is build more leaders, not more followers.
Yes. I just for the record, I hate that concept of followers.
But that's what you do when you answer. I had one client that he had one employee that would ask the same questions over and over and over. How do I do this again?
Yep.
The manager would get all frustrated. He'd go over and do it for the guy.
Yeah.
Answer his question or give him. The guy never had to learn.
Sure.
I mean, you're creating this incompetence, you know, and perpetuating the incompetence.
It's sort of like, it's sort of like recovery. You're just enabling someone to underperform, and you're enabling your own arrogance, frankly. It makes you feel good, but it's disastrous for your workforce.
Right. Yeah. You've got to take a longer term view for that. Now, employee engagement is huge. Did a presentation on that a few years ago and stuff. I think I remember the percentage is 17% of the workforce is unengaged or actively disengaged.
Yeah. The latest numbers from Gallup, I think it's 13% of the workforce, national workforce, is actively disengaged, which means they're drilling holes in the back of the lifeboat.
Yeah.
And 52% are not engaged, which means they come to work, they do their job, they go home, and they forget it. 33 or 35% are actively engaged. They're the ones that are driving performance, driving value, driving innovation. And, you know, if we could just figure out how to take a handful of those 52% that are not engaged and make them actively engaged, you see an automatic hit to profitability for growth, value, innovation, et cetera.
Yeah. And they say that the U.S. economy or businesses in the U.S. are, I guess, are losing billions each year.
Billions.
Just from the disengaged. And we were talking about it the other day. It's not just that the employee is disengaged or feels disenfranchised and they're not working. They're probably talking to all the people around them. So none of those people are working. Right. They're also calling their spouse or their friend. Yep. So now that company is disengaged. It's just, it's a ripple effect.
And I think that's where the whole idea of culture comes from. If people are disengaged, they go to work, they do a job, they go home, they forget about it. They're talking to people and that's just breeding that culture of non-engagement. On the other hand, if you can turn that culture around where people's voices are valued, where they are respected, where they are appreciated, that also breeds culture. You think about our national culture, and you know, national cultures are often a product of stories. You know, we all grew up with stories of you know, George Washington cutting down the cherry tree. One of the stories, it's the same hospital I just referenced. One of the stories is, and talking about courage, is not long after they had started this cultural transformation, a nurse, oncology nurse, was getting ready to deliver chemotherapy to a patient. She noticed that there were a couple of tests that hadn't been done. So she asked the attending physician what she should do. And he said, well, they're minor, go ahead and deliver the therapy without it. But they're trying to develop this culture of safety and putting the patient first. And so she thought, I'm not sure that's the right thing to do. So she called the chief of oncology services about what she should do. And he said, yeah, you should absolutely do those two tests before you deliver that therapy. And I'll call your attending physician just to make sure that's clear. Well, so she said, okay. The attending physician got the phone call from the boss, who then went back to the nurse and ripped her to shreds verbally. And so she thought, you know, we're trying to operate around here. We're trying to develop this culture of safety. So she called again the chief of oncology services and explained to him what had just happened to her, who then went back to the attending physician and did the equivalent of pulling, you know, the safety cord, which is like they call it the safety alert. It's the equivalent of shutting, you know, someone pulling the cord to shut down the manufacturing plant in Toyota. The medical officer told the attending, you will be pulled offline until we can do a formal investigation, because what you just did is counter to the value of respect, which is what we're trying to build around here. So how long do you think it took that story to ripple through that organization? And the influence that had on building a culture, not only just a respect, but really that culture of patient safety. That nurse, it took her enormous courage.
Absolutely.
To do what she did. And also that chief of oncology services, that took him enormous courage as well, because those high valued, high paid doctors, they're the economic engine of the healthcare system.
Sure.
You get one of those people angry and they leave, they take patients with them.
Sure.
So it took lots of courage and on all levels to make that story and make that culture work.
Wow. But you know, that's what's important is when you put in a process, here's the process we follow. and it's tested and it's approved and it, you know, the quality that's going to come out of that process as long as it's followed. You can't allow anybody, no matter what their level is. You know, my wife and I joke, if you've ever seen the television show House, right? The medical doctor, he was kind of a jerk, but he was so good at what he did that he could get away with being the jerk. And so I always say, you can't be House unless you really are House. And even then, there's dangers involved, right? You have to go along with the program. And there's a book. There's a good book out. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's called Black Box Thinking.
No.
You know, when an airplane goes down, we do everything in our power. The NTSB, everybody gets involved to try to find the black box.
Yes.
Because that black box tells us what was happening at the time. The engine, the flaps, all the gauges and everything. Right. What was happening when that accident happened?
Right.
When things go wrong in the hospital, a lot of times they go, you know, that's just life.
Yeah.
Things happen. It's like, no, no, no. Let's stop. Let's review everything that happened and see if we can keep this from happening in the future.
Yeah. Right.
And the
right.
whole book is all about that specific topic. It's
cool.
It's a great, great book. Wow. Yeah. So talk to me about courage. How do you, how does a company create this culture of courage?
Well, so I'll tell you another story. It's really a remarkable story of a woman who barely graduated from high school. By her own estimation, she says, I was not the smartest one in my family, but I was certainly the most social. She barely graduated from high school, went off to college, barely got in, didn't know what she wanted to do, thought she'd try education until she did her student teaching experience and said, education is not for me. Ratchet forward, probably 15 years later, she's now an educator. She loves the classroom. She loves education. And she's gotten her master's degree. She's board certified. Now it's time to try being a principal. So she took over the school as the principal. There, it was the lowest performing school in the district of 18 elementary schools. There is open infighting within her staff. The prior principal had been run out by the teachers union. And it was the place, it was a neighborhood of 65% free and reduced lunch, which means a neighborhood of moderately high economic and ethnic diversity. When she took it over, I thought she did something that was absolutely brilliant. She gathered her staff, including the custodians. And one of the things that she did anyway was develop rules. And she, you know, she, as I was interviewing her, she said, we went around the room and identified all of the rules within the team, as well as places where there should have been rules, but there were no rules. And she said, we had all of these ideas up on the wall. And then she said, when we were done, I said, okay, now let's rewrite the rules. And she and her team, 75, you know, educators, including custodians, they wrote their own rules of how they would conduct themselves and run the organization of a local elementary school. Now, that doesn't sound like a whole lot of courage, but I think it takes enormous courage for any leader, and I would say that an elementary school principal, we all should be modeling more of their leadership. Anytime you give that kind of power to your team, that's a scary thing. I would even say a lot would think that's terrifying, because you're giving the power of rules to your team, and then your job as a leader is to reinforce those rules. So, you know, the value to Aaron as the principal was, when someone was not performing or behaving according to the rules that the team had identified were important, her job then was to reinforce those rules and say, you're taking yourself off the team because we as a team determined that these are the rules that were, that's going to govern how we relate with each other and how we serve our students. That takes a lot of courage.
Sure.
And to say nothing of empowerment, of empowering the staff. But the result of that and a few other things was that in 5 years, this school went from the lowest performing school in the district to the highest performing school in the district. And when that wasn't good enough, they took it up another notch and became one of the few schools in the nation to actually close the achievement gap.
Wow.
And that school is no longer just a school for kids. It's a neighborhood school in every sense of the word. If you go to that school on the Saturday morning before school starts in September, there'll be 50 to 75 volunteers working in that school, cleaning it, pressure washing sidewalks, cleaning rooms where medically fragile children will be coming, and helping teachers prepare their classroom.
That is excellent. Which brings up another topic, discretionary effort. You know, we talk about discretionary funds. If you're going to Las Vegas for the weekend, you have some money set aside that you can blow and not worry about it.
Right.
Employees have discretionary effort. They have knowledge they bring from their previous jobs, previous employees that they can choose to share with your business.
Right.
If they're engaged, they'll share that readily. If they're not engaged, you hear things like, eh, I could do it, but that's not what I'm paid for. Right. That's not my job. Right. They don't ask me, so why should I help?
Right.
That discretionary effort can go a long way. And just what you described, where they will actually take their time to come in and do things, not for their benefit, but for the benefit of the school or the company.
That, you know, when you see numbers that, I think the latest number is that organizations with high employee engagement has like 22% more profitability.
Right.
That's 22% more profitability. That's the value of discretionary effort. And actually, Aaron, the elementary school principal, I think, provides a great case study for that idea of discretionary value. When she got done at the end of the year of her first year being a principal, she looked at her budget. And she discovered she had a $14,000 surplus, which for a school principal, it's kind of a good deal, because you want to get fired quick as a principal, overspend your budget.
Right.
And but when she got looking at it further, she realized that the reason she had a $14,000 surplus was because the little church that meant rented the school and for their Sunday services had given them a $15,000 donation. Wow. She had actually overspent her budget by $1,000.
Wow.
But when she got thinking about that, she realized that that little church represented a value that, if she could capture that value, could add additional value to her students and their families. She also, as well as her staff, she also realized that there were other community groups that were literally standing on her doorstep saying, can we help? But the other principal had just pushed them all back. So if you go to that school today in the, when the school is starting in the fall, and they're doing teacher in service trainings and these kinds of things, you'll find at lunchtime, there's a lunchroom of food all laid out. And it's being provided by this little church, which happens to be a church of high ethnic diversity. So the food is really, really good.
Sure. Wow.
And nice. what she discovered was that all these various community groups, they could add discretionary value to her students. Mm-hmm. And it didn't cost her or the district a penny.
Nice.
All she had to do is say, okay, there's a few formal things we got to do. But the only thing she had to do was say, come.
Wow.
And she was able to capture that additional value at no cost to herself or the district.
That's a great story. That is awesome. Very cool. So, Dan, how many people do you have working for you at Praxis?
It's me, and then I have some associates where I go out and grab them based on the client and the need at the moment.
Okay. And prior to that, in your other jobs as management consultants and stuff like that, were you a leader? Did you have teams that work for you?
Yeah. The last organization I worked for, I was a senior project manager, running basically my own team. organization. Before that, large national consulting firm. I was a senior project manager again. I was, again, depending upon the client, the mix of clients. I was managing multiple projects and multiple teams at any given point in time.
Okay. So if I'm wandering the streets up in the great Northwest, up where you are, and I bump into one of your former employees or colleagues, what would they say about you? What type of leader would they say you are?
Great question. I would hope that they would say he's passionate about serving the customer. I would hope that they would say he was equally as passionate about helping me and my professional as well as personal growth.
Nice. And do you keep in touch with any of those folks?
Yeah. Maybe, as a matter of fact, I do.
Nice. Very cool. Lita, and you work for leaders, you work with businesses, with the leadership team, the executive team and stuff like that. What type of courage do you think is most important for an effective leader?
In terms of the individual leader, I think it's really the courage to see the value of their team. It doesn't sound like much, but you know, there's so many times when we are given a position of leadership, you know, it's just so easy for that power to go to our heads. Yeah. And we think, well, I have, and you know, I'll admit, you know, my first leadership role, I totally blew it. Fortunately, I had a boss who gave me a second chance. But, you know, it's easy for that power to go to our heads. Yeah. And I think the effective leader says, it's not about me and my power. It's really about the team and building a cohesive team and really respecting and valuing, you know, the team. And we use that word empowerment, which is, like I said, it's a nice word that few people know, few of us actually know what to do with it. And it's grossly overused. But when we actually do know how to empower our team, it's, you know, it's stunning what happens. Sure. And it takes courage to turn that power thing off, and give it away.
Yeah. Yeah. Like we were saying, it's not about removing the barriers as much as it is giving them the tools that they need to get through the barriers that are going to come up. Right.
You know, it's a great analogy. I actually describe it as it's a process of freeing the workforce to fully demonstrate their full human capacity for creativity, for innovation, for transformation. You know, we believe that we as human beings are special, mm-hmm. that we all have innate capacities, that we all have, you know, the ability to do the miraculous and to knock down walls and barriers when they present themselves. Yet when we come to the workplace, so many times it's you sit there in that chair and just do what you're told.
Right.
And all that other stuff that comes that you are as a human being, that thing for creativity and innovation and brainstorming, just we don't really want to pay for that. Yeah. And yet we do, and it's free.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. The whole thing about, you know, don't tell them what to do, but tell them the result you're after and let them kind of figure out how to do it and then coach from there.
You want to
be a mentor. You want to be a coach. Yeah.
Yep.
Very cool. Well, Dan, this has been phenomenal. If people want to get in touch with you or reach out to you, and where can they find your book? What's your website? You have a couple of them, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. The simplest one, actually the one I keep up the most with right now, is danieleds.com.
Okay.
And they could find the book there, both the hard copy as well as the electronic copy. You'd find it on Amazon. It's actually a better deal if you go through my website.
Okay.
And I also have on the resource page, mm-hmm. there is a special report that I'd love to offer your listeners. Sure. It's called Creating Cultures of Courage. Excellent. There's three of them there, but there's one there specifically on a culture of courage, and more than welcome to go to the resource page and it's theirs for downloading.
Excellent. And what's the title of that again?
Creating Cultures of Courage.
Perfect. That is awesome. And I think that's what I'm going to title this episode, Creating a Culture of Courage.
I think that's a great title.
Yeah, I think that is so important. But again, thank you so much. What's next for you? You've got Praxis going. You've got your books. What else is happening?
Well, I'm really transitioning Praxis Solutions from looking, you know, working in the area of process improvement, team performance, to really looking at creating cultures, designing cultures. One of the things I've learned in the process of writing the book, and I initially started out just looking at leadership, but as it came together, I realized it's really about culture. Yeah. And that is such a massive need today, especially as millennials are coming into the workforce, are beginning to establish themselves in positions of leadership. They're all about the experience of the employee. Yeah. Don't give them the experience they're not looking for, and they'll walk. I raised one, I might be a little bit biased, but I actually love millennials. I'm transitioning my entire practice right now to really looking at issues of leadership and culture, because that's where the change and transformation is at. Mm-hmm. And so if anybody wants to call my phone number, it's on the website. Love to chat with them. Just to kick around the ideas. Sure. So the next step for me is really to start engaging individual leaders and organizations around the design of the culture.
Excellent. So another book in the works, you think?
Well, I'm exhausted from doing this last one. But if I was to write another one, I would probably take the basic ideas and really talk more about the genetics or the DNA of culture. Nice. The metaphor of DNA and genetics really came about because it works. Mm-hmm. Human DNA is its own system, and it beautifully demonstrates the power of systems and systems thinking. I mean, you think about it, DNA, there's two basic elements in a DNA molecule, phosphate and sugar. You know, two elements that are in every household kitchen. Mm-hmm. Yet the way these elements interact at a molecular level is the reason you're sitting there and I'm sitting here and we're having this conversation.
Exactly.
And you have a good looking goatee and I don't, and you have blonde hair and so do I, and we're both gray a little bit. Exactly. But that concept of DNA is so powerful because we organizationally, we actually have the power to design the organizational DNA. And it just takes some courage to do that.
Excellent. Good job. Well, I'm excited to keep up with you and see what's going on. If you ever get any calls from businesses out of here in Atlanta and you need a collaborator, I would love to
help. I would be just delighted to do that.
I think that'd be awesome. Dan, thank you so much again for being on the podcast. I will put all your links in the show notes so everybody will have access to those. Listeners, hope you enjoy this. Definitely go out and check out Dan Ed's website, check out his book, and the free report that he's got available for you out there under the resources page, right?
Yep. Great.
All right. And that's it. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, make sure you share this with your family, friends, and colleagues. And stay tuned because there's always more coming. That's it for me, Coach Harlan Singh. So long for now.